Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in Fort Virginia Prescott. Here's how Native history reads for many Americans. Indians welcome pilgrims at Thanksgiving. Tribes sent west on the Trail of Tears. Lots of fight with cowboys, reservations, casinos. And now they're fighting the American government again over an oil and gas pipeline out west. That leaves a lot of holes that get filled in with stereotypes, prejudice, and myths that have misinformed generations. Europeans brought culture to the backwoods and savage Indians. Indians are predisposed to alcoholism. Most are on welfare. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz and Dina Gilio Whitaker have written a new book to dispel all these myths. It's called All the Real Indians Died Off and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans. Virginia spoke to them earlier this week.
So just that title, All the Real Indians Died Off. What is a real Indian?
A real Indian, the reason that we have that title in there is to emphasize the concept of real. It goes back to the core myth. The core myth in this country is the myth of the vanishing native. And from that myth, we can trace almost, if not all, the myths that we name in this book. And so when you talk about Native people vanishing, which is a settler fantasy, we then talk about the concept of authenticity. So Native people, if Native people are all gone, but yet we know that there are at least 3 million to 5 million Native Americans, you know, that identify themselves on the U.S. Census, and 567 federally recognized tribes in the United States, there's a paradox there. And so the way that that plays out is that, okay, there might be Native Americans still left, but they're not real Indians because they don't meet the stereotypical understandings of what an Indian is. And all those stereotypes are, you know, based on they don't look the way Indians in the 19th century look. They don't dress that way because they live in a frozen, unchanging past. They can't be modern. Therefore, they are inauthentic.
It is amazing how well-formed a lot of people's picture might be if you say Indian, and it does harken back to these 19th century images. But how about that term itself? Indian, Native American, you said tribe, some say nations, First Nation, Indigenous. Is there a right thing to call you and people of Native American descent?
This is one of our myths. They don't even know what to call themselves. It's one of the myths. Just because all of the words are colonial words, Indian is not, you know, none of them are equal to the N word except for redskins. That is equal to the N-word because it, you know, what it harkens back to is genocide and heads being cut off by pilgrims and early settlers for bounty and the bloody corpse that's left. But other than that, Indian, Native American, Indigenous peoples, which we use more and more, these are terms like Africa and Europe and Asia. Those things mean nothing about the specific cultures. And we use them as generalities, but of course Native people prefer to be called by their nationality, by their national name, you know, Cherokee or Lakota, Dakota, Oglala for the Sioux.
Well, I notice you don't actually even use the full word redskins in your book. You use an asterisk in the book. And you mentioned that this is a name that the colonists actually called Native Americans. One of the feel-good narratives that surfaces at this time of year leads to one of your myths, that Thanksgiving proves that the Indians welcomed the pilgrims. Did they?
Not really. Not exactly. Not in the way that the myth has been perpetuated. You know, we talk about in the book, we go into the actual history based on the primary source documents about what actually happened. What happens is the Plymouth colony, the Mayflower people come, they set up in the middle of winter, they are starving, they encounter the Wampanoag people, and the Wampanoag people are surviving this dramatic depopulation due to an epidemic in the last couple of years. And so both people are in a state of desperation. The Wampanoag are compromised militarily in their battles or their conflicts with the Narragansett. So what they are faced with is a situation of mutual desperation, and so they form a treaty with each other. So this friendship is really based on a need for mutual political self-assurance, and that's really the story that gets woven into this feel-good narrative about, you know, Indians welcoming pilgrims. I mean, within the next, 50 years, it degrades into a full-scale war. So this period of peace doesn't last very long.
And you know what's important about the myth is that Thanksgiving, when it was invented by Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War, had no pilgrims and no Indians. It was only about families coming together during war, being together, being thankful, and mourning their losses. So it was not created, the myth wasn't created until the Depression. And school teachers picked up on it and innovated all the, you know, the hats and the costumes and everything. So it's a completely made-up myth very recently, only in the 30s, when they're trying to create a new American nationalism. So, you know, Thanksgiving should go back to its origins and not be about pilgrims and Indians, but be about Thanksgiving, just families being together and eating together.
Well, how did these kind of myths and the myths of, you know, the savage Indian or the other narrative of the noble savage Indian support United States policy against the Indians and all that bloodshed that followed that first Thanksgiving?
Well, it was needed because the Europeans needed a justification for coming and taking of the land. I mean, you know, most of us by now know what the concept of manifest destiny is, you know, this divine right that the Europeans believed that they had, you know, granted from God to inherit the land. And so the way that they did this was they created these narratives about indigenous native inferiority. And that goes back to before they even came here. It goes back to the days of Spanish law and the formation of international law. It morphs into this doctrine of discovery. The doctrine of discovery is the very embodiment of this concept of Indian inferiority, which grants the right of the superior conquering race to come in and take over.
We're talking with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz and Dina Gilio Whitaker. They're authors of a new book, All the Real Indians Died Off and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans. Well, as we said, there are big leaps, big gaps in the kind of history that most Americans learn about Native Americans. But right now, what we are hearing about a lot is the protests against the completion of the Dakota Access Pipeline. A number of tribes, I think more than 250 nations, have joined together in support of the Lakota Sioux and protecting their sacred land. And now this is something, a protest that has spread all over the country. Why now? Why do you think there is this emergence of political activity? Or do you think we're just hearing about it?
Well, I think what's galvanized this new or seemingly new movement is, number one, the messaging. The messaging is all about water. Because the water system of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation is perceived to be compromised, and it is, by the building of this pipeline underneath their lake, it brings up the worldview of the Lakota people. Maniwichone, water is life. And it just so happens that it's the same water supply for 17 million people downstream. So it's not an isolated issue. It involves all kinds of other people. So it's, you know, these multiple stakeholders that are involved. And I think there's also something that, you know, with the tribes, other tribes getting involved, to me it seems to be a message of a collective enough is enough, of having treaties be trampled on, their rights continually violated, because it's not happening just at Standing Rock. It happens with every tribal nation in this country. They are all fighting various different battles. And so this is just one of those moments in time that brings it all together.
But it's also true what you said, that it's being noticed this time, because there are struggles going on constantly all over the Americas. It's hard to keep up with them, you know, if you're on a news feed that gives them to you, but people don't hear about it unless they get on those feeds and are informed directly. And when Red Warrior Camp was set up in April, it didn't get any attention at all outside of, you know, Native media until August. So it was kind of a surprise, and I think, you know, Dean is correct that it had to do with water and also the recent Flint crisis, that people felt a sense of identity to it that didn't make it, to them an esoteric Native issue. But there is an esoteric Native issue that people should learn, and that is about the treaties and the treaty rights Native people have, that this pipeline shouldn't have been built or approved of at all.
And this is something we learn more about in your book, you know, the number of myths that U.S. presidents were benevolent or at least fair-minded towards Indians in the past, that the U.S. did not have a policy of genocide. I mean, these are really, I think for a lot of people, will be kind of shocking ways to think about the history of the United States. But also I want to just talk for a little bit about the protesters. And you do... you do, in your book, also talk about this kind of idea that Native culture belongs to all Americans. This is something that was especially embraced by New Age culture, this neo-paganist, or this idea that, you know, the Great Spirit belongs to all of us. In one way, that is unifying. In another way, not. So how would you look at it?
Well, we talk about the... the concept of how, in the context of New Age appropriation of Native American spirituality and ceremonies, how the First Amendment gets deployed to justify it. It becomes a free speech issue, and that's been argued a lot in the New Age literature. And what that does, it's a universalizing narrative. But the point that we make is that this universalizing is, it completely sidesteps and evades the fact that for example, in this case, in Native spirituality, the cultures and the religions, the spiritual practices of Native people were built on very specific histories. They come out of very specific languages and very specific ways of living. And so when you factor all of that in, there are particularities that don't translate. You cannot say that Lakota sacred ceremony means the same thing to everyone, and that because of that, everybody should have a right to it.
But do you think on some level that narrative and the appropriation that comes with it may have a lot to do with why people are learning more about Native American culture than they probably learned in school, or, you know, reading Black Elk Speaks when they were in college?
You know, it's a double-edged sword. They're not really learning about Native Americans. They're learning about a certain image. You know, it's sort of the way they appropriated Hindu practices, gurus, or Zen Buddhism. You know, they take it out of the cultural context and make it an individualistic thing, whereas it's a collective. You know, it's a for Native people, it's a community, a collective that brings people together around principles of living, and not just ceremonies as a performance. But the other thing is that this appropriation also evades politics, evades that Native people can be political people. For example, the environmental movement that has been active for almost 50 years now has been blindingly white and upper middle class. And now with this, with the Standing Rock, with this pipeline issue, Native people took the handle. They took hold of the leadership. And this is really the most positive thing at all.
Well, Roxanne, Dina, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Virginia Prescott there, speaking with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz and Dina Gilio Whitaker, authors of the book All the Real Indians Died Off and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans.